Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Chatter for Change. I am Preston, joined in the booth with Lily, Caitlin, and Gabriel. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here today.
Oh, me too.
Exciting stuff.
Oh, we got a great episode for y'all today. Joining us from our nation's capital, we have Ashley Westerman. Miss Ashley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Preston and crew. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely.
We are very excited to talk with you a little bit, get to know you a little bit more.
Absolutely. So I understand that you grew up here in Western Kentucky and graduated from the same high school we are going to right now. Can you tell us a little bit what it was like for you to grow up here?
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct. I did graduate from Webster County High School in 2006, which seems like a millennia ago. Growing up there was interesting, I will say. For your listeners, I am I'm the daughter of school teachers, and I'm adopted. So I am adopted from the Philippines. And I was adopted at 10 months old. I came to America, and then I became a citizen at two. And growing up in Webster County was interesting, to say the least. Being a minority in a majority white community was tough sometimes, but it also offered me a lot of really good opportunities. I can't really compare my upbringing there to anywhere else because that is literally where I grew up. So I'm definitely a Western Kentucky farm girl at heart. But I will say that growing up as one of the few Asians in the community was certainly challenging at some points. But I also learned a lot from it as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about college. Where did you go to college after you graduated from Webster County High School? And what advice would you give to seniors like me who are trying to make that college decision?
Sure. So I went to the University of Kentucky in Lexington. So I did stay in state. My parents went there. And they seem to have a great time. So I was kind of destined to go there. I'm also a really big University of Kentucky fan. So it just seemed like a good fit. Other things that went into the college decision for me was finances and experience that I was looking for. Finances being I got a full ride to the University of Kentucky. It was a mixture of a diversity scholarship as well as academic scholarship. And then opportunities, I was a double major in journalism and political science with a minor in philosophy. And the school just offered a really good program, really good programs for all of those things. And so I would say, you know, if I were a senior now and looking at colleges and what to sort of do next, you know, definitely consider your finances, where you can get scholarships, what you can afford. That's really important, particularly because our student debt crisis in this country is insurmountable almost for many, many people. And then also, what do you want to experience, right? And experience can be everything from what academics do you want to pursue? So where are the programs, the best programs for you, or the best programs that will offer you the kind of education that you want? But also experience as in, like, what do you want to do? Who are the people you want to surround yourself with? And maybe that is a big state school, like where I went, that had a gajillion things to do all the time. It also had a very large Greek system. I was very interested in being in a sorority. My father was in a fraternity in college, and he had a very good time and made a lot of lifelong friends. That was important to me. Also, being in Lexington was important to me. It was a bigger town, and I got to experience people and things from all over the world while I was there. But maybe that's not for you. I mean, maybe you'd rather go to a smaller school closer to home so you can come home more often. That's totally fine. Or maybe you want to go to a religiously affiliated school because that's an important part of your life. So I guess bottom line would be go somewhere that is going to help you do the things that you want to do and grow into the person that you eventually want to grow into.
I like that. Thank you.
Well, and so, sorry, did you say you were a double major and then also you had a minor is whenever you were in college?
Yeah. So when I was, when I started college, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. And at the time I thought I wanted to cover Washington. I wanted to cover politics. That eventually I've evolved away from that since then. But, I figured that I would major in journalism, learn how to be a journalist, but also become intimately familiar with, you know, the workings of our country, as well as in political science is a very large field. And actually in college, I ended up my specific study in political science was Middle Eastern history, geopolitics, and I guess, yeah, basically Middle Eastern geopolitics. And because everybody was going to the Middle East at the time, at least all the journalists were. And so it was really important for me to have a political science background so I understood how governments worked, how geopolitics worked, so I could apply that to my journalism career later. And then the philosophy minor, I actually tagged that on at the end because I'm just I did it for fun, actually. I'm just very interested in thinking about, you know, thinking about the philosophies behind why people make political decisions. Philosophy is not just, you know, Descartes and Plato and do we exist? I mean, philosophy is also religion, philosophy behind religion, philosophy behind politics, and things like that. And so decision making, I guess, would be the best way to sort of boil that down. And understanding how and why people make certain decisions was really important to me.
So you said when you started college, you realized you wanted to be a journalist. So what made you like decide that? Like, have you been interested in that kind of thing your whole life, or just going into college, it kind of came up?
So my parents have had me listening to NPR particularly my whole life. At work we call that you know, I was an NPR backseat baby. Morning Edition, which is my show, the show that I work on, we would listen to that on the way to school. And All Things Considered, which is the afternoon show, we would listen to that on the way home. And then my life was just sort of always filled with current events and the news. My parents were definitely big watchers of the evening news. They had CNN on all of the time when I was growing up. Like some of my first memories was actually watching CNN and their coverage of Desert Storm in the early part of the 90s. And so my life has always been very, you know, aware of things going on around me, current events, politics, etc. But I will say that until about the summer before my senior year of high school, I actually wanted to be a veterinarian because I love animals. I love animals. I have a cousin. It is a big jump. I have a cousin who's a big animal vet, and she like did, you know, work in Thailand and stuff with tigers, and I love animals.
Oh, wow.
But I'm not very, I mean, I might be selling myself a little short, but I am very interested in science, but I'm not very good at it. And so when I kind of hit my senior year of high school, I had to think about, do I really want a really rough road ahead of me in, you know, a heavy science field, a lot of biology, a lot of all of that? Or do I want to do something else? And I've always been a good writer. I've always been a very good writer. I've always been a bit of a performer as well. And so journalism seemed like a good thing to go into, particularly because at the beginning I thought I was going to do TV journalism. but it was a decision that was made before I went to college. But it is definitely one that I have stuck with since. So.
Oh, cool. That's interesting.
So, yeah. Like you said earlier, you grew up in Webster County. So, how has your life changed since you've moved to Washington, D.C.?
That's a big question. It's changed immensely. That's a very big question. I am definitely not the same person I was when I was living in Webster County. My parents can attest to that, as well as their friends who know me and still keep in touch with me. You know, I came to Washington right after college. So I graduated college in 2010. I didn't like the job market because the recession had made it really bad. And so I went straight to graduate school, actually. And I went to the University of Maryland to get my master's in journalism. So that's actually what brought me to the area. The University of Maryland is right outside of the city. And, you know, it's not just the move to Washington. I have traveled a lot in my life, and I've gone out and seen things and done things that sort of has all sort of built up to the life that I live now. My life changing when I moved to Washington is more than just geography, but also, you know, my friends have changed. I have a very, very diverse group of friends. When I was growing up in Webster County, I was the only Asian and most people were white. So my dynamic has changed in terms of how I see the world and how I see my friendships. Yes, Washington is a city. So, you know, before the pandemic, we were eating, you know, at different restaurants, and such a big foodie city. And so you get to learn a lot of things through food and culture and things like that. But I also would say that I was already sort of predisposed to do that. And it's just adult life, which will come crashing down upon you very soon. You know, being an adult in I can almost guarantee you being an adult in D.C. is much different than being an adult in Webster County. It's just very different. It's a really, I know I've sort of like danced around this question and not answered you at all, but it's just changed immensely, and it's changed who I am, and for the better, for sure. I would say that it's certainly a life that I did not anticipate for myself when I was your age.
Well, that's interesting. So you, we're talking about, so you're saying is that like the change that Washington had was more than just, I guess, more traffic or something, but it's actually more of a your life thing. So it's like a change in friend groups and change in, I guess, like possibly an outlook of how you see things.
Absolutely. It's a holistic change. When you move away from the place that you're most comfortable being, you will change inevitably. It doesn't matter who you are. When you come into contact with different people or come into contact with different experiences because you're forced to, you will change. And that is something that I think, you know, is never explained to you as a teenager. Like, sure. It's just something happens to you. I moved to D.C. in 2010, but I actually also left D.C., I lived for 2 years in New Orleans as a reporter, and that was really interesting. And I've traveled a lot during my time. So, it was definitely more than just more traffic and more restaurant choices.
Right.
So was that a hard transition for you? Because for me personally, I'm a homebody, and I feel like it would be really hard for me to move really far away from my parents. So I was just wondering how it was for you as far as that goes.
Yeah, so I think I look at my transition into adulthood sort of as stepping stones, right? So I moved from Webster County to Lexington, which was a little bit bigger, to DC, which is a little bit bigger. And I'm getting ready to move to a megalopolis in Asia. So, I mean, I see it that way. So that's how I see my life, right? My parents also did a very good job of making sure we were well-traveled, even as children. We went to places all over the country, in different parts of the world, for summer vacation. So I was introduced quite young, actually, to larger places with more people. My first trip back to the Philippines, I was in, how old was I? I was in middle school. The city where I was born is a megalopolis. It has the second biggest population density, second most population density in the world after Tokyo. And so there's millions and millions and millions of people who live there. And just learning to sort of navigate large cities as a kid was really helpful. I've been to DC actually many times before I moved here. My first trip to DC, I was maybe 8. And I knew how to ride the subway by the time I was in my teenage years and coming here. So it wasn't a big transition for me. I was sort of already headed there. Also, my parents, sort of made it very clear that I would not be staying in Webster County. It would not be in my best interests. And so, I may have fought them at the time, because like you, I was a homebody and I couldn't imagine being anywhere away from them, but they did a very good job of shoving me out of that nest and making me realize it's what was best for me. But, you know, for someone like you, I mean, yeah, if you're a homebody and you can't imagine being away from home, I would just say try it someday. Go visit. Once the pandemic is over, if you have an opportunity to go to a college in a slightly bigger place, meaning slightly bigger city, you know, take small steps if that's what makes you comfortable. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. And that's okay, too.
Thank you. That's good advice. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. So on that note, I would have to imagine that transitioning from here to the literal capital of our nation is probably a big adjustment. So what exactly is it like to work in the capital?
Oh, it's so fun. It's so fun. You know, there's just so much to do here. All of my friends, or at least the people I surround myself with, are really interested in going out and, you know, seeing museums and walking around, you know, D.C. just in general. D.C. is more than just the Capitol building and all the monuments. I mean, the neighborhoods here are so unique and so interesting and different from one another. That's very cool. You know, before the pandemic, it was a lot of fun because, I mean, I took the train to work. I walked to work. And you just see different things and different people all the time. And then after work. So my building is actually a few blocks away from the Capitol. And then after work, you know, D.C. is a big networking town, I would say. And if you're seniors and you haven't heard the buzzword networking, then your teachers aren't doing their jobs. but it's a really good town to go out and just meet people for both professional and personal reasons. And when I say professional, I mean I go out and meet with other journalists. I'm part of journalism associations that meet, and this is all pre-pandemic, of course. I mean, they're doing it virtually now, but they go and they meet at a bar and they, you know, you exchange cards, you exchange business cards, and then you have a connection to someone who you might need something from later. It's a big town for that, and that's really great. And so that's a very interesting aspect of living in Washington. The other interesting aspect about living in Washington and what sort of makes it fun is that there's so many government workers here that every time the administration turns over, you get a whole new group of people, which is kind of cool.
Oh, okay.
And the internship scene is very similar because all the government agencies have interns, all the news organizations have interns. And so you're always getting sort of this constant transient group of people coming in and out, and the city is never the same from one year to the next. And that's definitely a fun, interesting thing about living in and working in Washington.
Gotcha. Right. And, I guess talking about your job at NPR, I've seen looking at over, I guess, some of the stories that you've written, which are very good, I guess. But What was the, I guess, what is your, maybe the, your favorite or your best, most well-known story that you did at NPR?
I think there's two, actually. The most satisfying story that I was ever able to do was actually a story that I did about finding my birth mother in the Philippines. I sort of had to approach that story as a journalist, or I like mentally wasn't going to be able to do it. It's very emotionally taxing. But I was able to do that story, and I wrote about it, and I did an audio story about it. And that story has kept going, which means that I did it in 2018. I did it as sort of a service to other adoptees. Being adopted is still, even in 2021, kind of taboo. People sometimes don't understand what to say to me when I say I'm adopted. I mean, really, like, in reality, you shouldn't say anything because we're just normal people like you. But it still sometimes makes people feel weird and uncomfortable. And so it's really important for people who have a platform as big as NPR to tell those stories so people don't feel alone in their experiences, right?
Right.
And so I did that story in 2018. And I think about once a month, I would say, I get an email from someone, I don't know where they are, but someone who is also adopted, who is interested in possibly finding their birth parent, and they want to talk about that experience with me. And so I was very, very proud of that. It was very hard. Luckily, I had an excellent editor who was able to pull things out of me that I didn't even realize were inside of me. So that was probably my most impactful piece of journalism. My favorite, I would say, or I guess the other thing that I am most proud of is in 2017, I was sent with a colleague to go cover a refugee crisis in Asia that turned out to be the largest mass exodus of refugees, since World War II. I was sent to the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar, where these Muslim refugees from inside Myanmar were being expelled by the Myanmar military because they are Muslim and Myanmar is predominantly Buddhist. So we went there, and it was one of the hardest assignments I've ever had. It was hot. It was, you didn't speak the language. Definitely didn't speak the multitude of languages that were going on around you, and just sort of being in a refugee camp for 18 hours a day for 2 weeks is really hard. And just the stories that we heard were very hard as well. A lot of really horrible, horrible stuff happening to these people. But we were one of the first news organizations on the ground to cover that. And then it ended up later being the largest mass exodus of people, largest movement of people since World War II. So that was a very important story to tell, even though it was very, very hard. And I am of no, I'm pretty honest about what we heard and what happened there. And I will just say that I was very affected by it afterwards. Have thought a lot about that assignment ever since, and still cover that story, actually. That was probably my favorite, because I felt like we were telling the world about something that they didn't really know about.
Right. I would imagine that's also a very important story also to be heard. So I guess, switching over to, I guess the process of becoming a journalist and stuff like that, I'd imagine it wasn't exactly an easy road, I'd imagine. And so I just wanted to know, to get there, what was, I guess through all everything that you went through to get to be a journalist, what was, did you have a source of inspiration, or how did you get your determination to be there, to go from college to working, to becoming a journalist?
Like I said, I grew up around news, and I grew up in a household that found news and information and truthful information to be very important. So that was the foundation of me wanting to be a journalist was understanding that the free flow of information is critical, particularly in a democracy. Also, I had very good professors at the University of Kentucky that instilled in me this idea that we should speak truth to power. We should not let people tell lies or falsities or in untrue things. We shouldn't. And we shouldn't let people get away with things like that because it does nothing but hurt and misinform. And I had really good professors who made that very clear to me. That taking on governments, taking on people who are in control is actually really good for democracies and for the free flow of information. So I'm very dedicated to that. I'm very dedicated to the truth, and the truth being both people's experiences as well as actual truths, so facts, but truth can also be nuance as well. And I say that because diversity is very important to me. Making sure that people with many intersectionalities like I have is very important to me. And sort of being offered the privilege to tell other people's stories correctly as well as accurately is a huge driver for me in what I do. It is probably one of the biggest, most important privileges that you can have is to be trusted with someone else's story. But also, you know, holding truth to power is very important.
Gotcha. So we here at True Blue are a drug prevention group. I was wondering if you have ever covered any kind of drug-related issues during your time at NPR.
I've helped cover the opioid crisis. I have done that. Through my show, I personally have never done, I've never done any stories as the main reporter on something like that. But as a producer, I've helped my staff and the hosts on our show do things like that to cover the opioid crisis, particularly in Appalachia, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky. As you all know, it's an epidemic. So I have done a little bit of that. I've also covered drug. Let's see, how would I say this? And you guys can edit this. I've also covered drug rings in other countries, drugs coming out of particularly Southeast Asia. A lot of people don't know this, but the meth being made in Southeast Asia is actually that market is actually many, many times larger than anything being made in the United States. I'm not saying that it isn't a crisis here. It absolutely is. But there is a larger crisis there that is going mostly uncovered. People don't realize that. And so I've covered, I've helped cover things like that. But I have to say, I am not regularly on the drug beat in at least in this part of my career so far, no.
Gotcha.
So what would you say has been the obstacle you've had to overcome to get where you are today?
Just one?
No. Well, I guess. What were your biggest obstacles?
The biggest.
Oh, I'm not sure if I can just point to one big obstacle. There are many. There are many as a woman. There are many as a woman of color. There are many obstacles as a young person.
Let me ask this then. Okay, what's the biggest obstacle you didn't see coming? Let me say that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. That actually does make sense. The biggest obstacle I didn't see coming.
Is that still hard to answer?
It's still hard. I would say the biggest obstacle that I didn't see coming was. don't even know. My life has been absolutely chock full of obstacles. So I'm not quite, I know I'm kind of like crashing your podcast, but I just don't see them in that way. And obstacles can come in a lot of shapes and sizes, for sure. Here's one. An obstacle that I actually took on later in my career that I didn't anticipate taking on. Diversity in media, for sure. I work for a news organization currently has a very certain people. Our audience believes we have a very certain sound. There's this myth of the NPR voice, and like, what does that even mean? It used to mean, and I would think that maybe, you know, some older people would think that it used to mean in like the 80s and 90s, these, you know, very soft spoken hosts that, you know, almost whisper when they're on the air and very, very high intellectual thought and conversations and analysis of news and things like that. But that's not what our country sounds like. And if NPR wants to sound like the rest of the nation, they need to diversify their voices. They need to diversify their sources. They need to diversify their stories. It is no longer acceptable for a news organization not to be thinking about diversity at all levels. And I've sort of taken up that mantle a bit at NPR, and I will continue to take up the mantle of diversity moving forward. I think I have a pretty good foot to stand on, given I grew up in a very, very white place where I was the token diversity person most of the time. But I still, you know, am fighting for my stories and the stories of people who look like me in my adult life, which was kind of interesting to sort of come into. I didn't ever think that I would be fighting for those things. But it only makes us better. And it only makes us more authentic, I think. So I would say that the pushback, I'll say this delicately, the pushback on diversity initiatives was definitely an obstacle in my career that I didn't realize that I would come across, and has now become a big part of who I am and just sort of my ideals as a person and as a journalist.
Interesting.
So we heard, like you mentioned earlier, you have a big move coming up. So can you tell us a little bit more about this, and then why the Philippines?
Yes, I do have a big move coming up. I'm moving. I'm leaving my job. Leaving my job after 6+ years and moving to the Philippines. It is my home country. I am still a citizen there. Fun fact, because of the United States' very close relationship with the Philippines, people are allowed to be dual citizens.
Wow. So, oh, nice.
So I'm moving there to tell stories outside or to tell stories out of the region. Ever since, over the last 5 years or so, I have gotten really, really, really into things and current events and politics and things like that in Southeast Asia. It's very important to me. That region of the world, along with the Pacific, meaning everything from basically, I'll say everything from Myanmar to Easter Island, it really interests me, and that's a big part of the world. But I have been trying to cover that area from Washington, and it's just not possible anymore. You have to be there to tell those stories correctly and accurately and honestly, to do them justice. And so I'm moving back to my home country, I guess, though I also do consider America my home as well. But so I'm going to go out there and be a journalist. And once COVID figures itself out and goes away, I'm really excited to be, in a region that I'm very interested in traveling throughout. I've traveled actually to a lot of throughout a lot of Southeast Asia. I'm going to go do that for a little bit and see if I can make it as a foreign correspondent and, you know, go live my life somewhere a little bit different, which has always sort of been a theme of mine in life. Always looking for something to do that's just a little bit different.
So with telling those stories in the Philippines, are you going to an area that knows English, or did you have to learn another language like Cebuano?
So the Philippines is a big English-speaking country. Mm-hmm. Actually, English is one of its two official languages, mm-hmm. English and Filipino. I think the better question would be, are you going to the Philippines to learn better Filipino? So yeah, there will be language barriers.
Yeah, and of course, throughout.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, my dad
has actually been to the Philippines like 7 times, I think. And mm-hmm. we had a few Filipinos stay in our house one time, and it was crazy because they could talk to each other in Cebuano and mid-sentence switch to English and start talking to us. It was crazy. They are so good.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when you, that's great. I mean, I would love to become as fluent in Filipino. So Cebuano is the language of the middle part of the country, but Filipino is sort of the overarching language of the entire country. But you know, that's so great that you got to see that you got to experience that, because it's really important to understand that people who can speak multiple languages are actually engaging different parts and more parts of their brain than people who can only speak one language. It's actually a sign of a bit of a higher intelligence in a lot of ways. So in the Philippines, it won't be so hard, but in places like Cambodia, and Laos and Thailand, they don't speak as much English. In Indonesia, they speak mostly Bahasa, though I will say that English is definitely the language of getting things done, because that's at least the language that everyone can sort of meet in the middle on. But it'll be a challenge. It'll be a fun challenge, though.
So to kind of wrap it up, I have one more question. This might be hard, but if you could do it all over again, would you do things exactly the same, or is there some things you would change?
I wouldn't do anything different.
Wow. Mm. That's awesome.
I would not do anything different. I see my challenges as stepping stones. I used to be really angry about some of the things that happened to me when I was growing up in Webster County. I faced a lot of racism and a lot of hate because of the color of my skin. But, you know, in the end, that just makes you stronger. So I would change absolutely nothing. Even in the darkest depths of my biggest bouts of depression and feeling that I was, you know, as useless, you know, or feelings that I was just completely useless, you know, there's always another side. And I would not change. I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't change moving. I wouldn't change leaving NPR and going to Louisiana for 2 years. I would never change that, which seemed like a crazy risk at the time. You know, I wouldn't change coming back to DC. I wouldn't change some of the other decisions that scared the heck out of my parents. but I felt very confident about them at the time. So it's been a long road, but I honestly wouldn't be where I am and the person that I am and with the confidence that I have if I hadn't gone through all of that. And so, no, I wouldn't change a thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, Miss Westerman, I'm afraid we are out of time. Your story has been pretty incredible to listen to and react to. And I want to thank you so much for coming on our show.
I want to thank you guys so much for doing this. This is so great. I love that you guys are doing this.
Well, I wanted to let you know that we really appreciate you coming on. This has been another episode of Chatted for Change, and we will see you in the next episode.